Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today is our second part. Today's episode is the second part of a two-episode series on John Steinbeck's novel, To a God Unknown. I wanted to do two episodes on this because the novel is both fascinating, complex, and periodically mystifying. And I wanted to get a few different perspectives to understand it better. Today's guest is Dr. Michael Boyden, a professor in both the Department of Modern Languages and Cultures, as well as the Institute for Culture and History. His primary interest is in American literature, with a special interest in eco-criticism, Anthropocene studies, and critical sustainability studies. I read a fascinating article that he published on To a God Unknown, looking at some ecological perspectives on the novel, and I was fascinated to talk to him about it. We cover a lot of things, some things similar to my first conversation with Dr. Rivers, but we explore some of the ecological topics in more depth. Please enjoy our conversation. So, Dr. Boyden, I want to start with an easy question. What's your favorite Steinbeck novel, and which one do you think is most underrated by scholars? So, two parts.
Okay. The most underrated one is probably the one we're talking about today, isn't it?
I think so.
The God Unknown, which has generated quite a bit of attention in recent years, I would say, thanks in part to the fact that it's newly relevant in relation to droughts and climate change and things like that. But still, most scholars are very divided about this book's literary qualities. It's very heavy with symbolism. And from the beginning, critics were quite unsure whether this was, in spite of the fact that Steinbeck himself worked on it for several years and considered it to be an important book, it never really was a seller. And it's only after, in the 70s, after his death, that scholars rediscovered this novel, but remained a bit unsure whether it was really an interesting book.
Yeah. And what is your favorite Steinbeck novel?
I'm a fan of The Log from the Sea of Cortez. Have you read that one? It's not a novel. It's a sort of a naturalist narrative of an expedition he did with Ed Ricketts.
I have not read that, actually.
1940. And yeah, most students will skip over that one because it's nonfiction, but it is very revealing, very interesting in terms of it teaches us a lot about Steinbeck's mindset during those crucial years in the 1940s when his sort of environmental ethic took shape. So I'm interested in that phase and in that book specifically. And it's also, it reads a bit like a novel. It's quite a good, well-written text, which doesn't have that overwrought symbolic style which you get in To a God Unknown. So I recommend that one.
Where did your interest in Steinbeck come from?
I'm not a specialist. I'm not a Steinbeck scholar. I'm more of a 19th century scholar myself. I wrote my second book was about environmental determinism in American literature. And one of the reviewers I submitted this manuscript a couple of years back to a press, and one of the reviewers said, why don't you focus on the afterlives of this kind of environmental determinism in 20th century texts? I don't know if you're familiar with these doctrines of environmental determinism in relation to the climate, so the assumption that people are fundamentally shaped or influenced by environmental factors. And this was a fairly dominant ideology up until the mid-19th century. And in a way, it never died. And I would say Steinbeck is an example, perhaps, of how it survived. So once I finished my book, I just, for pleasure, I started reading Steinbeck novels. And I came across a very interesting monograph by Gavin Jones, a professor of English at Stanford, who explores these interesting connections between Steinbeck and people like Ellsworth Huntington, who was a geographer at Yale, who is infamous now because of his association with the eugenics movement. But he developed this theory of climatic pulsations. And the influence of those theories is visible in novels like To a God Unknown. So that sparked my interest, and I started reading more and decided to write an article about it. And I also assigned it for a course on eco-collapse fiction. And my students liked this novel, actually. So they were intrigued, and we had quite interesting discussions about it in class. Yeah,
Yeah,
that's.
I will want to dig into that more later because I do think the morality and the way that Generation Z or newer generations engage with text makes To a God Unknown more relevant today than maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago. We'll circle back to that in a second. One
Sure.
more question about your background. How do you think your broader research interests in 19th century inform how you read Steinbeck? How do those things intersect in your mind?
As I said, this environmental determinism never really died. It goes in waves, you could say. For us today, I think it's newly relevant. And Steinbeck was really. This is what I try to argue in my article. It was really in his youth, he was influenced strongly by people like William Emerson Ritter, who developed a kind of biophilosophy at the time, which assumes or takes for granted that we are biological beings and that we should study humans in relation to their environment, which he considered to be a shaping influence. And this is something we lost along the way, probably, which is one reason why Steinbeck, I think, fell out of favor in the 50s and 60s. This kind of biologism, as it is called, was really unpopular among critics then. And perhaps it's something we're now rediscovering. So I'm not sure if that makes sense, but that's a trajectory that interests me, and it makes this novel in particular a very interesting one.
Okay, one random question before we jump into A God Unknown.
Sure.
Do you enjoy reading Moby Dick?
I'm a big Melville fan, and I enjoy. There's many ways of enjoying a novel. If you enjoy The Grapes of Wrath and the kind of descriptive chapters that he inserted into the novel, perhaps it's not such a leap to discover Melville's Moby Dick. But
There are some
I think
similarities
that.
there. Let's talk about scholarship and To a God Unknown. Broadly speaking, how would you describe the benefit of engaging in literary criticism to enhance reading of a novel? So someone that doesn't regularly engage with that, what are they gonna, what's that gonna, how's that gonna help enhance their reading?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think of course, a lot of criticism is written for other critics, right? And it's a self-perpetuating thing. But I do think that generalist readers can learn from various critical perspectives, various angles that allow them to discover new things in classic texts that they otherwise would not be aware of. Which is not to say that you have to read up on all the Steinbeck criticism because that keeps you very busy for a long time. But I do think that it enhances your reading experience in a number of ways. And if you're aware of what critics have written and the ways in which they made sense of texts in the past, I think that enriches the reading experience. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I do have this pet project idea. I think maybe, I don't know, with ChatGPT or some kind of tool, I would almost love for there to be miniature versions of scholarship that are accessible for a lay reader so they could dip in. Because sometimes you read, recently I've joined a book club where we're reading a lot of 19th century novels, a lot of Shakespeare. And sometimes I'll jump into the secondary literature and you're just overwhelmed by caesuras and Pyrrhic substitution and all this jargon. And the lay reader wants to access it because they want to do a deeper reading, but there's so much jargon standing in their way. So it almost to me feels like we need an in between. Maybe what this is, that's what this podcast is, but you
Probably,
know, so,
yeah.
yeah, an in between for people to access. But I want to jump to your article about To a God Unknown and talk about it a little bit. What is ecological holism? What does that mean?
Yeah. This notion of holism was actually, the term was coined by Smuts, a South African statesman and scholar. And by holism, he meant that the whole of an organism, say, is more than simply the sum of its parts. And this was an idea that Steinbeck picked up on, especially in his early works, and that he tried to dramatize or, yeah, narrate in some of these texts that we've already discussed or mentioned. So it was quite influential in the 1920s and 30s. The premise is basically that groups of organisms, groups of people, groups of animals have a mind of their own. And that is the guiding idea you find in those kind of philosophies, and that Steinbeck also used in his fiction.
Let me ask you this, because I read a number of eco-critical readings of To a God Unknown, and I was wondering in my head how Steinbeck would view that kind of reflective reading of his work, because maybe this is just my background in religious studies, but when I read the text, eco kind of critical reading didn't come front of mind. It was more religion that came front of mind, the Vedas in the front. And obviously, Hinduism is blended with ecological views of the world, but it felt like more religion was front and center. How do you think Steinbeck would look at the eco-criticism of his work?
I think it would confuse him slightly. And I reference a text that he wrote in the late 60s where he talks about deep sea mining for a popular magazine, science magazine. And that's the thing that I think eco-critics have insufficiently grasped in their reading of Steinbeck's work generally. Steinbeck, he was an environmentalist, late bloomer, I would say. So in the 60s, he wrote a number of very environmentally conscious texts, but he also had a rather utilitarian take, or almost entrepreneurial take on nature that would sit uneasily with current conceptions of environmental awareness. So readings of Steinbeck's novels, in light of ecological concerns and deep ecological concerns specifically, are problematic, I would say, in a number of ways. And I think my reading is corrective to that, or at least an attempt to reach a fuller understanding of where Steinbeck was coming from with his ideas.
Okay. What do you think of the comparative studies that have been done tracking the similarities that To a God Unknown is like a proto East of Eden that's setting up these kind of broader themes that he'll explore at length later? Do you think that's overstated, or do you see what they're pointing to there?
Yeah, I do see those connections, some of which I also point out in my article. I think To a God Unknown really is an important early novel, which has been neglected by critics, but which prepared the ground for the more mature novels that came later. And I do think that it allows us to understand where Steinbeck, how his philosophy developed. And it was a bit piecemeal. He read widely, and he was not a theoretical mind, I would say, but he was earnest in his ambition, I think, and quite consistent also in the kind of themes and issues that he brings up in his novels.
Would you say this is his most philosophical work in that sense? Because there's a lot more philosophical engagement with this work than a lot of his later work. And I'm just kind of curious how scholars think about, because I know that there's an element here of a novel is a different kind of text than a philosophy text. And so approaching it from that lens is going to leave you with gaps. And because that's not, he's not, this is not being in time. This is not the Critique of Pure Reason. This is a literary text. So how do we think about philosophy in relation to that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think what appeals to me when I read this novel is that Steinbeck inserts these kind of vignettes, short narratives, short encounters between man and animals, which are really fascinating, really intriguing, and it really sets you thinking in ways that I think philosophical treatise doesn't, because he's not trying to be coherent in any fashion.
Okay. I gathered that.
But he puts in a lot of information, and he was at the time he was also reading The Golden Bough and things like that. Very symbolic. Try to insert all kinds of symbolic layers, which isn't all that successful, I think.
Yeah, we're definitely going to talk about some of the heavy handedness here in a second.
But what does intrigue me are these kind of short and descriptive passages where he tries to dramatize, I would say, these philosophies that he was trying to work through. And he does that in a really interesting way, and I think it's still relevant and pertinent today.
Okay, one more question about scholarship before we jump into tone and style. A lot of the female or woman characters in this book feel incredibly flat to me. And I'm wondering, I didn't do too much reading on feminist scholarship around this novel, but I can't imagine it's celebratory. What would a feminist reading lead us to conclusions about this particular novel?
I haven't come across any sustained feminist readings of this novel in particular. I think there are, of course, a number of readings that go into gender issues and race issues in this novel, but it is troubling in some ways. This is one of those things where I don't quite know how to place the young Steinbeck, and I think the fact that he worked so long on this particular novel is a problem, because he inherited it from a friend's manuscript, right? I don't know if you know about the genesis of the book, but it started out as a play and it didn't work out, and then he said, I'll do it. And then he worked on it for 5 more years, and it rewrote it several times, and it was really an overworked manuscript, and that shows, I think. But it also makes this a very interesting book to explore for a scholar, but perhaps also for a student of literature who's interested in these kind of issues. Organicism, this is the philosophy we're talking about, holism or organicism. This was very important to Steinbeck, and it is actually important now, since the 70s, I would say, with notions like symbiogenesis, which was developed by Lynn Margulis. I think people are returning to these assumptions about holism, which fascinated Steinbeck at the time.
I think he probably could have benefited from a writer's workshop or a writer's room with this one. A little bit of feedback. Let's talk about some of the tone and style. I'll admit, so the symbolism here for me felt heavy-handed. I understand he was reading a lot of Jung, so he's had archetypes fresh in his brain. So I think there's a lot in the background here, but how do we account for the dramatic style change from Pastures of Heaven, which is pretty realist narrative, has some supernatural elements here and there, to something this extreme in the other direction? Is it, and I don't feel like we see it again in future writing in quite this capacity. So is this a one-off style experiment in your mind?
I think he was looking for his voice. So he started working on this before The Pastures of Heaven. So he was developing a kind of magical realist style, but it didn't quite work. And I think afterwards he became more confident and he developed a more kind of realist register, which worked better for him.
Okay, so a bit of an experiment. And then how much biblical literature and Vedas and literature from Hinduism, how much do you think an average person needs to read to really appreciate this novel? Because it's just rife with allusions. It's just like allusions on every page. And allusions are tough because I think people treat them as Easter eggs sometimes. And I don't know if that's necessary to appreciate the work. So how do you think background, like what people need to really engage here?
I think you don't need all that background. What it helps to understand what Steinbeck is trying to do, but he was also teasing us into thinking about certain issues. For instance, the title itself is an allusion to the Vedas, as you said, right? But it also references the Christian Bible, and it does both of these things. So in a way, he brings together two very disparate traditions, and he cultivates that ambivalence. And sometimes it's a little annoying, but in other ways, it's very stimulating. So I think he exploited that biblical kind of register quite a lot in the book, but he also questions it and destabilizes it through these kind of references to the Vedas and other traditions, Mexican
Do you
folklore.
see animism at work here? Or is that the wrong reading? Trees being inhabited by spirits and whatnot?
Yeah, I would call it animism, yeah. But the interesting thing is that you get different perspectives on it, right? You have the four brothers, and one of them goes along with that line of thinking, but not all of them. So they do represent various perspectives that clash and that offer us different ways of engaging with the natural world. And he exploits those differences consciously, I think, in the novel.
Okay, one more question. This is going back to the style conversation. Do you think this book is overwrought?
I do think so. I think it shows that it's an early Steinbeck novel, but that doesn't keep me from assigning it to students. So it is an interesting book. It doesn't have the kind of stylized quality that other Steinbeck novels do possess. So it's not a classic text in that regard. But in terms of the kind of philosophical orientation of the author, it is much more revealing, I would say, than Of Mice and Men or novels like
Okay. Let's talk about some of the characters. Would you say a majority of these characters are simply archetypes? A lot of them feel like they're on one-track minds with their particular, what their disposition is. Would you say that's a fair reading of the different characters here?
to some extent, but as I said, you get these different perspectives, these different affinities, so to speak, and even within the same character, you're not quite sure what they represent. So, in the case of the protagonist, Joseph, we can talk about that later if you like, but what scholars have discussed most extensively is the ending. Is this a sacrificial deed that sort of redeems the land somehow? Or is he deluded? Is he simply going crazy? And is it simply a coincidence that the rains return after his death? And I think you can, both readings are feasible, which is why it's such an interesting novel. So Steinbeck deliberately inserts these kind of passages that allow you to doubt your interpretation. So they're not simply archetypes in that regard. So you're forced to reflect on the motivations of these characters and, yeah, the ways in which they themselves get sidetracked in a way by certain assumptions.
Would you consider the landscape a character in this novel
Yeah, that's a
with
good
some
one.
agency?
I do think so. So we talked about the magical realist passages. There are a few in the novel where the landscape comes alive. And I find those passages quite well written. I like them. I don't think they're overwrought, or the depiction of the landscape is very vivid and very compelling there. Yeah, I would say the landscape itself is the main protagonist of this book.
Okay, let's talk about a few different characters because I want to pick your brain on how we should look at them. Benji is an interesting character. He's not on, quote, screen all that much, but he seems like a central figure and represents some kind of balance of maybe sin and innocence. And there's a dialectic with him. How should we look at Benji and what role does he serve in this novel?
I think Benji, he represents sensuality, I think, for Steinbeck, and something that appeals to Joseph in many ways, but that he cannot quite channel in the same way. So this kind of almost suicidal dedication to life is what characterizes Benji. And if you link it to the kind of biophilosophical theories that I mentioned, such as Ritter's, Benji is an instance of a maladaptive individual who's suicidal in a way, or whose actions just lead to his early death. And
I
Joseph's
think. response to his early death was strange to me. How do you look at that? The way he mitigated that and he just moved past quickly. I was confused by that, to be honest.
So was I. Yeah, I think that makes this Joseph character so interesting. He's unable to connect with other people, with his own family, but he does feel this very deep connection to the lands. And the question then is whether that's simply an illusion, right? Or whether he truly merges with the landscape. And it's an open question. I think my reading allows us to interpret Joseph's behavior in light of these kind of biophilosophical doctrines that I mentioned, but there are other ways of reading it. So, what do you think, Jordan?
Yeah, it feels a little bit like speaking through that environmental determinism, it just feels like almost like a seasonal change. There was just a movement of the weather or something, and it wasn't like he almost dehumanizes in some way Benji at a certain point and makes him part of the landscape that is just always in flux. So that's how I looked at it, but I'm sure that's an impoverished reading. I wasn't sure how to address that. The kind of his situatedness, but then how quickly things move from past that. So I'm not sure, to be honest.
One way of reading it is that he fails to align himself with the group. And this was central to Steinbeck's preoccupations. He thought of, or he conceived of humans as group beings. And the group itself, for him, had a mind of its own, was some sort of super organism. And Joseph is completely on his own. He fails to really make those connections. And so, if we go along with that reading, it's a tragedy, right? It's a tragic ending to the book. But other critics have actually indicated that his act of self-sacrifice is an expression of ecological awareness and connection. So, both readings have been developed by critics. And I do think that. Yeah, there's something to both approaches. The question is how you connect them. And I think if you dig a little deeper in these kind of theories that Steinbeck digested during his early years, you can reach a fuller understanding, I believe, of his philosophy.
Yeah. Let's jump to significance here. How do you think Steinbeck's career would have been different if he kept writing in this manner? Would he be a kind of proto-environmentalist, someone that would have been taken up in the 60s? Do you think he would have been as successful if he'd written in this manner?
Yeah, good question. I'm not sure. I think it's a good thing that he developed as a writer, that he developed a new style. And he did meet Ed Ricketts around the time when he was working on this manuscript. And that might also explain why it's full of references to not just religious texts, but also biological treatises. And I think it's a little much in the end. So it's a good thing that he moved away from that. But when it comes to the kind of issues that he was interested in and that he consistently developed, also in his later works, the place of humans in the biological, in relation to their biological heritage, etc. I think those issues are very central to this novel in ways that are less visible, perhaps, in the later farming novels. So they're more on the surface, and for that reason, I would say it's good to return to this book, even though I would admit, from a literary standpoint, it's not his best novel.
What should we make of the fact that Tortilla Flat comes after this, which tonally is so different? It's a novel with the eccentric characters that just kind of leap off the page, don't have these kind of archetypal dimensions to them. Should we view that as a turn or continuing in this kind of time of experimentation and finding voice? How should we think about the relationship between this and what comes next?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure. I think the fact that this novel didn't sell at all is definitely a factor. The critics largely ignored it, and when they did notice or did pay attention, there's a whole collection of the contemporary views of his early work, and most critics are very negative about the heavy symbolism that we discussed, and that simply didn't work. So he moved away from that because he needed to establish himself as a writer. And I think that's a very straightforward explanation, but I think that's the most logical one. And perhaps is in the first episode you discussed the role of his wife in as an editor. I think that might actually also have played a role. So his discovery of authors like Hemingway, etc. So that, yeah, I think he matured as an author with Tortilla Flick, which was really like his first, the novel that made him famous.
Yeah. Let's talk about secondary literature now. I'm sure you had to do quite a bit of reading as not a solely Steinbeck scholar and doing background. What secondary literature did you find helpful in understanding Steinbeck? That could be biographies or articles or certain scholarship by specific people. I'd love to hear your background in research and preparing to write this article.
Yeah, so I mentioned Gavin Jones's book, which is really a useful study. The title is Reclaiming John Steinbeck, which I appreciated a lot. But I also went back to Richard Astrow's work on John Steinbeck and Ed Ricketts, published in the 70s, early 70s. And that study is much more profound in its approach, or much, much more nuanced, I would say, in its approach than later eco-critical readings, in that it shows the differences between Steinbeck and Ricketts. So Ricketts had a very specific non-teleological philosophy that he derived from his time in Chicago when he was a student there. And Steinbeck assimilated that to some degree, but he also had these other, yeah, imbibed these other ideas from people like Ritter in California, which were very different and went in a different direction. And if you look at those differences, I think you can understand, can reach a fuller understanding of Steinbeck's environmentalism.
Okay. If people like To a God Unknown and are looking for other literature that kind of resembles it in environmental perspective, is there anything that you'd recommend that you discovered, something that's on a parallel track but not from Steinbeck?
It reminds me a little of the Latin American magical realist authors. It has
So, 100
affinity.
Years of Solitude and stuff like that.
Yeah, I see a lot of connections there, even though there's no direct influence there. But it's interesting that this magical realist style emerges in the 1930s in that particular setting. So, in European writing at the time, you also have that kind of almost vitalist style, which is very interesting because people turn to magical realism when they cannot find other ways of engaging with reality, right? So often post-colonial authors use it because it allows them to critique the colonial center in ways that realist fiction doesn't. So there's a political dimension to it. And I would say that, yeah, I would place this novel in that kind of tradition.
We always close these podcasts with book recommendations. These can be about anything we talked about or just things that you're currently working on that are exciting to you. I'd love to give our audience a few recommendations.
So I mentioned Locke from the Sea of Cortez, which you skipped, Jordan. I would recommend it. It reads like a novel. It's interesting. And it's also sort of an homage to Ricketts, even though it also shows how the two men differ. And those kind of conflicting elements come together in that book, which is a, you know, 20th century version of Darwin's Voyage with the Beagle, but then, yeah, in a completely different setting. That one spoke to me, and I reread it as I prepared for this chat. So I recommend it to readers.
Okay, fantastic. And last question, what are you working on next?
I'm writing a book on pandemics.
Oh,
Pandemic
fascinating.
fiction, yes. So I'm reading a lot of pandemic fiction from Catherine Ann Porter to all the way to Ling Ma's Severance, recent zombie
Did you read
novel.
Hamnet?
No, I haven't read that one.
Yeah. Do you know the background of that novel? It's the, Death of
Yeah.
Shakespeare's Son. And I think there's a movie adaptation this year. It's getting a
Right.
lot of traction right now. But yeah. So is it stuff written during pandemics or thematically about pandemics or both?
The project, it's an emergent project, but the working title is Leaky Fictions. So
Oh.
I look at how they deal with spillover events, but also how they, in terms of their use of genre and medium, how they use platform culture. So the COVID crisis was, I think, the first real platform pandemic, in the sense that people were commenting on Twitter, other social media, as it happened, right? So this is very different from, say, the influenza epidemic, where there was a big silence for many years, and then after, say, 10 years, the first novels appeared. And this is very different now with COVID. I think there's the same kind of tension between visibility and invisibility in relation to this pandemic, but the information ecosystem has changed so much that I think it also creates a new kind of fiction. And that's what I try to focus on.
Well, Dr. Boyden, this has been a real pleasure for me. Thank you for helping us come to
Thanks
some
for
more
inviting.
concrete footing on a complex and often misunderstood and I think in somewhat opaque novel. I appreciate your perspective and your insights, and I feel like I engage a little better now. I feel like I have a slightly firm footing, so I appreciate you taking the time to chat with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.